most places I could go out and I just knew I was going to catch them. But when I put myself on a river or a creek, it was like, am I going to figure this out?
Time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
So now that I've hit 36,000, I've more or less hit a wall. Things came to almost a dead stop. I almost got myself skunked two trips in a row. And here I am doing a podcast where I'm supposed to be helping people learn how to catch more fish. But I am tragically human, as I like to say. And even, there's days when they just do not want to cooperate. I went to a place called Rexmere Lake.
Hold on.
Which is...
Are you trying to say that you got skunked?
No, I did not get skunked. I avoided it, but skin of my teeth. I'm still on a roll, but they really, really challenged me. This Rexmere Lake, it's a lake I go to. It blossoms late. I mean, it's usually July before the lily pads are up. It's at a high elevation, and the water is typically cooler than it is everywhere else. It's typically a month behind most places as far as, you know, spring fishing, summer fishing. You go there in the spring, and it just doesn't happen. So the late spring fishing there usually is in July, that really hot, aggressive bite. I went there, and the pondweed, there's a pondweed that mats up on the surface early in the year. I mean, we see it on big lakes, small lakes. It's just the first vegetation to come up and top out. And most people see that and they go, well, that lake shot, because it covers the surface in a lot of the, you know, all the way around the shoreline. You can't get to stuff. But a month later, it's the first one up. It's the first one to die back, and it's gone by July, and you got all this shoreline cover you can work. Well, I discounted that fact, and I typically wait till July. I was there June 3rd, and everything was weed choked bad. And I got in there. I was there 2 hours. I caught a grand total of two largemouth. I had others on that wrapped up in this grass and got off. But typically, there was a year I went there three different times and I averaged 70 bass each day. It's a great numbers lake. There's some good quality in there, but you generally are busy. Once you figure out what the deal is, they're busy all day, and it just didn't happen. I was there 2 hours. Like I said, it took me an hour and 10 minutes to catch the first one. It was crazy. It just not happening. So I said, well, I'm just not going to get anywhere here today. I love a good challenge. I figured a couple things out. The only thing I could get them to bite was a Senko, and I just had to fish it in little gaps and openings. So I said, I haven't been to my creek, Schoharie Creek, in weeks. I came back, switched out all my largemouth gear for smallmouth gear, ran to the creek, put the boat in. Cast after cast after cast, not happening.
Really?
Oh, the cottonwood trees had the surface covered with a flotilla.
Well, I tell you what, the cottonwood trees have got me covered, because I haven't been able to breathe in 3 days.
Getting all that white filament on your line, it's wadding up with every cast. You're having to clear the guides, the spool. This my favorite time of the year. But this too shall pass. And I caught one real nice smallmouth. I mean, out of the blue, only strike I had the entire time I fished that creek, which is incredibly unusual. I should have waited till evening and gone and fished it then. But no, I went right during the hottest point of the day, dealing with all the negatives, the surface flotilla and all that stuff. But I did, and I was stubborn. I used my grub because I figured my odds were best. Let's imitate the crayfish. That's what they're foraging on now. And out of the blue, I get this one real light strike. I mean, very barely perceptible. So I swing on it, and of course, I load up good, nice 2.5-pound smallmouth. This fish would not give up. I bring him to the boat. He's like, nah, I'm not done. Takes off again on another run. Bring him back in. Takes off on another run. It's like, I need to land this fish. I can't afford to lose it. I got to get him in to count it, which I did. Landed it. got one, and good grief, I kept fishing. I could not buy another strike. It was like the dog days of summer, June 3rd. But I prevailed, ended up getting one smallmouth. I did not get skunked. Didn't go down swinging, but I prevailed. But it was a challenge. It was a struggle. And better days coming. Matter of fact, once we're done recording, I'm helping a friend put a boat in on his lake, and we're going to fish that today. So right back after it. Let's turn this around and whack a pile of fish today. So what I want to talk about in this podcast is a couple situations that we all run into. The first one is clear water versus muddy water, why you should not be intimidated by either one. And the second one is how to fish moving water, which was a big challenge for me in the early days. I could catch fish everywhere except in a river or a creek. That was my nemesis. It was a 50-50 proposition. I had 100% confidence in all the lakes, ponds, reservoirs, all that stuff I fish. But if you put me on moving water, it was a 50-50 whether I'd catch them or not. That bugged the crap out of me. I want to have 100% confidence no matter where I go. So when it came to moving water, it just, I couldn't control my success, I guess is a fair way to put it. Most places I could go out and I just knew I was going to catch them. But when I put myself on a river or a creek, it was like, am I going to figure this out? And one of the things I did, if you have something that you need to conquer, well, put yourself right in the middle of it. I mean, and what I did is I forced myself into that situation and I fished my way back out of it. I joined a club that predominantly fished the Mohawk River, the Mohawk Valley Anglers Club. More than half their tournaments every year were on the Mohawk River. And my reasoning there was, I mean, why enter tournaments on water that you're not confident on? My reasoning there was, if I was going to pay an entry fee and pay money to fish someplace, I had darn well better figure it out. And that's, for me, that was a major incentive to figure it out. And looking back over my tournament wins, more of them have come on rivers than have come on lakes, which I figured lakes is where we did our best work. We won more on the rivers. So I guess the process worked. But the main thing about rivers and moving water is there's current. That's the big difference. And once you learn how, you can use that current positions fish. They don't sleep, they rest, but they're in constant motion. They do not want to constantly be in heavy current where they're going to have to expend all their energy and constantly, you know, rebuild that. They utilize current breaks like bridge abutments, boulders, rocks, deadfalls, channel bends, channel swings, anything that diminishes current. I mean, there's the inside bend of a creek channel versus the outside bend. You're going to have more current on the outside than you are on the inside. Shallow runs and riffles, the current accelerates. If you've got a certain amount of water in a river moving through an area and you've got a deep hole where you got, you know, say 15, 20 foot of water, and then there's a tail out at the end of that pool, you still have the same volume of water moving through a 15, 20 foot area that you do through a compressed 18 inch deep area. That volume of water is going to tremendously accelerate at that tail out, and that creates more current. That's a feeding opportunity, not in the tail out itself, but just ahead of it. The water coming into a deep hole and the water exiting a deep hole are both phenomenal areas where fish set up. They're feeding stations. If they want to actively feed, they're going to move to those areas, but they remain in the holes because the current is slower. It's easier for them to be around where there's less current, get behind rocks, behind boulders, bridge abutments. In some of these major rivers, you see a lot of boats fishing around the bridges. There's a reason for that. A bridge, abutment, or support is a current break, and they will hold fish. Take your electronics sometime. go to a bridge abutment and scan around it. You'd be amazed at what you see. Fish, if you study them like your life depends on it, you learn what the nuances of current and rivers and moving water and what they use and what they don't use to help eliminate that current and make their life easier. When I fish a river, I have long ago learned, and I apply this in most tournaments, depending on conditions, that shallow fish are feeding fish. My son's probably heard me repeat that more time than he cares to remember, but it's a lesson I learned years ago, and I repeat it to myself to remind myself that shallow fish are feeding fish. If they're there on a shallow flat, it's not because they're less current. It's because there are feeding opportunities there. There's bait fish, there's crayfish, there's forage fish. There's that's a cafeteria line. A flat is in a river. Now, they're not always there, but it's one of my first go-to spots to check, because if they are, they're going to bite because they're there to feed. And I just cover them with moving baits like swim baits, crank baits. If I'm fishing deeper, I'm probably going to fish a jig or something like that. But if I'm fishing a shallow flat, I want to fish a moving bait because fish are there to forage and they're seeking out bait. I can't tell you how many times on the Mohawk we've moved up to a flat in the morning and you see fish breaking all over the place. We always have one rod on the deck rigged with a swimming jig, or like a jig head with a Zoom super fluke on it that imitates a bait fish, that if we see a fish break, we can fire right there. And many days you hook up because that fish just revealed his location. He showed you where he was. I'll never forget the first time I fished with a gentleman named Gene Colorito, tremendous fisherman. We competed against each other for years and years in the Mohawk Valley Anglers Club. Had a lot of respect for each other, and we would always talk after the tournaments. Just highly respected each other. He was a gentleman, good fisherman. He thought the same about me. And we got talking one season, said, you know, we have never fished together. We should do that. We should do that. And this is way back. This is back before cell phones were commonplace. Okay. This is how far back I'm going. And after the tournaments ended in October, we set aside a weekend. The following weekend, let's just go out and fish together as friends. And we went out that day. We fished. He lived in St. Johnsville and right in town, a mile from the launch. So we met there. He said, well, we'll use my boat. I said, okay, we'll do this next year. We'll use my boat. And we went out on the Mohawk. And he knew a lot about fishing the river because he lived there. And I learned from him. And hopefully he learned from me. We started hitting the tributaries, which is a great program in the fall. If you fish a big river, fish the tributaries. Bait fish are there. The game fish line up in front of them. We were fishing tributary creek mouths where they come into the main river. And the first one we hit, we had a 20-minute flurry. We caught 8 smallmouth, 4 apiece. We ended up catching 52 smallmouth that day. I'd never had a day on a river like that before. And when we got off the water, we stopped at a Stewart shop and to get coffee and met a couple guys coming out. And they're like, do you guys fish today? We're like, yeah, we did. How'd you do? So that we did really good. We caught 52 smallmouth. They're like, 52? Holy cow, what were you doing? We were basically throwing tube jigs. And before I got home, I mean, I stopped at another Stewart's to get gas just a few miles down the road. After Gene got dropped off at his house, and there were guys walking out, said, hey, heard you guys really crushed them on the river today. How did you hear that? Like, Alan told us. I'm like, Alan wasn't even there.
Word, you know, travels, well, Roy.
Well, Gene had gone when I dropped him off. He called our buddy Alan, who was the president of the club, and told him what we did that day. Alan, in turn, called these other guys who went to Stewart's when I went there to get gas. I mean, all this transpired in about 10 minutes, and everybody knew about this, and nobody had cell phones at the time. So good news travels fast. I was just, how did you guys hear about that? Alan told us. Alan, he wasn't even there. How did all this happen? Was somebody watching via satellite? What? How do people know this? can't keep any secrets. But the reason I bring that story up, when we were fishing that day, we were on like our third creek mouth, and we're casting, and we both had a tube in the water, and a fish blew up on a bait fish just outside of that creek mouth. I dropped my rod and grabbed another one that had that swim bait on it and fired it in there. And the thing that surprised me is Gene's like, he nicknamed me Predator that day. He said, "Boy, you did that in about 2 seconds." I said, "That fish just revealed his location. We're not fishing blind. There's a fish right there, and he's feeding. You throw something else out there, you got a pretty good chance of hooking that fish." And he turned to me. He said, "Have you ever caught one doing that?" I said, "Yeah. Yeah, like half the time." I'm like, "Are you serious?" He goes, "Yeah, I've never tried that." I'm like, well, you should. He just revealed his location. You know there's a fish there that's actively feeding, but you got like a 2 second window to get your bait there, because when they hit something on the surface, they don't just sit there. They hit it and they move. They're on the move. They keep moving. So you've got like a 2 second window to get that bait in the water right where he was, if you're going to get his attention and get him to turn around and come back and hit your bait. But like I said, it's a 50-50 proposition with me. Half the time that works, you get a strike and you catch that fish. And more often than not, they still have in their mouth or down in their throat what you saw them break on. It's pretty cool. And we have closed out limits in tournaments, fishing flats on rivers, watching fish break and throw to them. It's a pretty cool deal. So if you're going to fish rivers, just maintain your circles of awareness. That's a term that Rick Klun often uses, but I use it too. Circles of awareness is just be aware of your surrounding and your surroundings and what's going on around you. If fish are breaking on the surface, they're feeding. Move in and capitalize on that. Schooling bait fish is a big deal down south, but hey, we live in the north. They do it here too. It's a universal program. So tune in, turn on, and catch some fish. The big deal with rivers, moving water, I fish the flats. And another big thing on those is areas that generate current. We've talked about fishing the locks and dams on a river where they have the water coming out. That's a feeding opportunity. Current creates feeding opportunities, channels, the water coming through, the volume of the flow. It has to be manageable for these fish. But another thing you can do, and this works, when boats go through a lock, when there's a boat coming down river, they have to release the water inside that lock via floodgates. And once the water level is down to the next level of the next pool, then they open the lock gates and the boats exit. When they're dumping that water, that creates a lot of current right along that bank there where the lock is located. And if you're there when they start dumping the water, that can turn on the fish. It can really turn on a feeding frenzy and opportunity. We've watched it, we've seen it, we participated in it. Doesn't always work, but when it works, it's the juice. So look for areas where current is concentrated, where it's diminished. Figure out, think like a fish. If you were a fish, where would you set up to feed in that scenario and fish it accordingly? Learn how to read the water. Look for current seams on the surface. They will tell you, you can see where fast current meets slow current. You can look for eddies, and that's where the water reverses, where the current switches and goes back upriver along the bank. Those are areas of slack water where fish will set up and they can just hang there and the food comes to them. But keep in mind that when you're fishing in general in a river, fish face into the current. They don't face downriver. They face upriver. You'll do much better if you keep your trolling motor in the water and move up current, casting ahead and bringing your bait back to you with the current. That's what appears natural to the fish, and that's what they bite the best. So there's my quick synopsis on rivers, moving waters. I want to move on to clear water versus muddy water. Most people prefer to fish clear water, but ultra clear water, Otsego Lake, you can read a newspaper on the bottom in 25 foot. That's clear water. And that goes to what you were talking about the last weekend you were out, the really clear water on Cannadice Lake, because of the zebra mussels coming in, filtering all the sediment in the water, which in turn allows the vegetation to return, which again, vegetation is a filter.
Right. The thing that I always have to like repeat in my head, usually wrong the first two times, is when it comes to clear versus dirty water and whether you use bright colors or dark colors. That scenario in my mind always gets mixed up when I'm in the moment, whether it's which use dark baits in dark water and you use bright baits in clear. Is that what it's supposed to be? Or what's the,
in clear water, I use natural colors. The clear water that it's like gin clear water. Fish can see everything. That's where you want to use the most natural colors you've got for the most natural presentation you can put out there. You want baits with a lot of detail, very realistic looking baits, anything in a natural hue, right down to, sometimes I use baits that are translucent. Young of the year bait fish, you can almost see through them. Before they start getting developed and start you, before you can tell what kind of fish they are, you can almost see through them. And if you're using translucent baits, they kind of replicate that. You'll have to downsize, of course. And a lot of times in clear water, you have to use like finesse style baits. But I'm not intimidated at all by clear water. I just, like I said, I use the most natural looking baits I've got and the most natural looking colors. I use a lot of soft plastics in clear water, the most realistic looking ones I can get my hands on, and in earth tones and natural colors and natural hues. If I'm using crankbaits, I use Strike King, Bass Pro Shops, some of the other lure companies, Rapala, they're coming out with photo imaging on lures. They've been doing it for years. And now, years ago, I used to take crankbaits that had all the paint tore off them because they were so productive. I would take them to a guy who did taxidermy and have him paint realistic bluegill patterns on them. Stuff you couldn't buy. Oh yeah.
What would that cost you to go in for him to go do like a handful of lures? What would that be?
Well, I'll give you an example of that. This guy wasn't painting crankbaits for me. Back when I was doing heavy construction, we built a paint shop for a guy who did painted cars, and he wanted to go in business for himself. So we built him a paint shop / garage on his property, right in the village of Fonda, right on the Mohawk River. And it was a body shop, but he did the painting because he did it for another company in the city, and he was very good at it. He just wanted to start his own business so that when he retired, he could generate his own income. So we built him this shop, and I had a spinnerbait years ago that was made by Stanley Jigs, and it was like a burnt crawfish. It was a burnt orange. It had brown and orange in it. Had tiger stripes on the blades. They were painted like a burnt orange. And I tell you what, you're talking moving water on Schoharie Creek. That spinnerbait outfished every other color 4-1, hands down. And I had one of these. I found it at a bargain bin in a Kmart store for $1, and it was the best dollar I ever spent. That poor spinnerbait, by the time I was done with it, it had about 3 stands of the skirt left. The paint was half chewed off the blades. The head had most of the paint gone. It was just a remnant of what it once was. And I had been looking for this spinnerbait for years. I could not find another one anywhere. So I called Stanley Lures. I think they were in Huntington, Texas. I think I'm going way, 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 way back. And I told them what I had. They answered the phone. That was called from a home phone, by the way, pre-cell phone days. We're talking a lot of my...
How long did you hold out before getting a cell phone, by the way, mister?
Good question for the guy with the digital camera and all that, right?
How long did you hold out?
Probably 3-4 years.
From when it started, from like the whole craze got going, 3-4 years.
Yep. had the flip phone with the push buttons and 3 letters on every key. Oh, it took me about 10 years before I started texting. Once I got a phone you could actually do it on, and people are like, Roy's texting? Yeah. Brave New World. I'm about 10 years behind the curve on about everything.
You do pretty well on the decks, though.
Yeah, I did. But they told me that color was discontinued about 6 years ago. It's not available anymore. Your best bet is to go to a Walmart or Kmart and look in the dollar bins. I said, well, that's where I found this one, 3 years ago. And it's on its last leg. So enter our first pilgrimage to Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri. It was the year my daughter was a junior in high school. So she was probably 16. We're talking 24 years ago now. And we went to Springfield, Missouri. We dropped her off at the high school. Here's another week I took off of work without saying anything. We dropped her off at the high school at noon on a Sunday. I paid for her to go. She was president of the international club, and I had paid for her to go to Europe for a couple grand for a trip to Europe for a week. And we dropped her off at the high school at noon, and I turned west out of the driveway, and we went west. We drove for 2 days and we got to Springfield, Missouri. 2 days in a car. When we got there in the parking lot, my son got out and kissed the ground. He was an hour into the ride. He was like, how much longer? We don't even ask yet. We had a Pontiac Transport van at the time, which we removed every seat in that vehicle except the three that we had. And coming back, you couldn't see out the windows. We had fishing tackle packed to the roof. But that was the plan going in. And we took two-way radios to have in the store. Again, no cell phones then. We had two-way radios where we knew it was going to be a big store, and we could just stay in touch with each other. And the first day, my son calls me on the radio. He's like, Dad, they have your spinnerbait here. I'm like, what spinnerbait? He said, that orange one. They got two racks of them. I'm like, where are you? He said, well, they got 7 aisles of spinnerbaits. I'm right in the middle. Come and find me. So I did. And
was it them? Was it the ones you were looking for?
Well, they had a burnt orange and brown skirt. I think they had a brown head. They had gold and silver blades. But I'm like, I built a paint shop for a guy in Fonda. He can paint these to look just like the other one. There were 42 spinnerbaits all together. And I just took the cart, put it parallel, and I took my fingers behind those two pegboard hooks and all 42 spinnerbaits into the cart. I've been looking for these at that point for 4 years. I'm not going to not buy these. He's like, do I get anything? I said, yeah, you get a finder's fee. You'll get a bunch of them. So I took them to this guy. To answer your question you asked 5 minutes ago, how much, I took them to this guy and I said, would you be able to paint these with your airbrush to look like this one? And he could tell what it was supposed to look like. A lot of the paint was gone, but he could tell what it was supposed to look like. And he said, I need you to paint the heads and the blades. He's like, yeah, I can do that. I said, yeah. I have 42 of them. How much? He goes, for you, $50. I said, all right, how long? He said, I'll have them ready in a week. I said, okay, call me when they're ready and I'll come and pick them up. And I did. $50. They look fantastic. I still have quite a few of them. The night I picked those up from him, I'm like, this lure doesn't exist anymore. They stopped making it. I'm the only guy now who probably has these, at least in the club I fish. And in a river, these things are, it's incredible how effective they are. Nobody, I've got a tool now nobody else is going to have. And I looked him straight in the eye and I said, and I will win a tournament using these lures. And I was probably 6 years later, I did. On the river, right behind his house. On the river. That tournament was held
in Fonda.
In the Fonda pool, and it was right behind the river, right across from his house is where we caught winning fish on his spinnerbait. You can't even make that up. Of all the places we fish, that's where I won with the lures he painted for me. So
I've seen a lot of people have quote unquote custom paint, on their hard baits.
Oh yeah.
You don't usually see a super nice job. Usually it's someone's just made their own change custom, on it, custom, right, with a couple of Sharpies. and they're putting the lines a certain way on it or something. But they, I mean, but that can make a difference. Obviously, it makes
it. It does. It does. Makes it more realistic. These crankbaits that I was taking to my friend Mark, who does taxidermy, he knows how to paint fish. Painting a lure is no different. You use the same layering and shading. I call him my mad scientist because he's always building his own lures. And he painted those crankbaits for me in a realistic bluegill pattern that you couldn't buy anywhere else at the time. I mean, we're going back 15 years ago when he was doing that for me. And those crankbaits caught fish. But now all the lure companies have super realistic photo imaging on most of the crankbaits. And I purchase a lot of those in the perch patterns and the bluegill patterns, because up here in the north, that's the predominant forage. That's what the bass in our lakes eat. That's what the walleye eat. They feed on a lot of bluegill and perch, smallmouth, largemouth, walleye, pike. All our fish eat those because that's what's available. We don't have threadfin shad. We don't have those crankbaits will still catch fish because they look like minnows and bait fish, but the perch and bluegill patterns are just really, really productive up here. And that's what I try to use in ultra clear water, because they're very realistic looking and you move them quick. They only have it. They've got to make a now or never decision. You know, they either hit it or they let it go by, and more often than not, they hit it. So that's my approach to ultra clear water, is the most realistic looking baits you can get. And this is important too. Don't get on top of your fish. Fish from a distance. If they can see you, I mean, if you can see them, they can see you, hands down. They can see that boat, and they tend to be a lot more skittish in ultra clear water. So make long casts, figure out where you want to fish, approach it from a distance. Don't make a lot of noise. Don't put a shadow on the water. Just be aware of the sun position, where you're positioned, and that you want the sun in your eyes, really. Wear good polarized glasses, wear sunscreen, cover yourself up. But if that sun is behind you, you're putting a shadow on the water, and that's going to spook fish, especially in ultra clear water. Now, muddy water, that's our friend. That spooks a lot of people. But muddy water, you can get a lot closer to the fish, and they're not spooky. But the thing to keep in mind with muddy water is, when it's muddy like that, the fish can't see as good. That's not a problem for them. People think, well, it's too muddy, that's going to give the fish trouble. No, that's their environment. They're used to it. There's some bodies of water that are always mud. Look at the Red River in Louisiana. It's a mud hole. But I fish mud holes. So Goodyear Lake is very often in the spring, in the fall with the rains. I have a buddy who refers to it as the mud hole. But we've gone to that mud hole with 1 foot of clarity and whack 60 smallmouth, because we know what to do when the water's muddy. They adapt to their environment. You got to get your bait a lot closer to them. But here's the thing with muddy water, you can get a lot closer to the fish without spooking them. And they typically move real shallow. They like to relate to something so they know where they are. And in deep water, there's not a lot to relate to. So they generally move to the banks, in rivers and in lakes, both. And they'll get near objects like rocks or laydowns or docks, something on the bank that they can get up against and relate to. So a lot of times in muddy water, if you fish around the objects, you're fishing around the fish. And what I do is I don't worry too much about realistic patterns at that point. I want a bait that makes its presence known. Something that vibrates like a chatterbait is phenomenal in off color and muddy water. Spinner baits are good. Rattling crank baits are good. Something that makes its presence known. If I use a jig, I'll add a rattle to the soft plastic. I don't know if anybody does that anymore, but if you look, you can find little glass rattles. They come to a point on one end. They got a couple beads in them. They're made to insert into the plastic so that your soft bait will rattle. And I've got those. I use those in off color and muddy water when I think I need to make my presence known. Find a rocky area, use a heavy jig, and let it bang and click on the rocks. Let the fish know that your bait's there. Make some noise, make some vibration. Topwaters can be good in muddy water. like a buzzbait or the old crazy crawler or your hula popper that you like to throw. That can be good in muddy water because it makes a lot of disturbance on the surface and lets the fish know that it's there, and they react. When the water's muddy, they have to seize the opportunities they get to feed, and trust me, they do. Now, you talked about dark and bright colors. Both are good in muddy water. That's when I go to especially dark. Now, not in clear water, in muddy water. A dark bait is something that will stand out in that off-color muddy water and be easier for them to spot. And conversely, a bright lure does the same thing. But if I'm throwing a crankbait in muddy water, I'm throwing it shallow. I'm throwing a square bill so it won't snag. But 9 times out of 10, it's going to have a brown back and chartreuse sides. That is just a killer bait in muddy water. If you watch tournaments that are held on off-color water, bodies of water, or rivers where it's muddy, if you look at the results, most of the guys that place high, they're throwing a chartreuse crankbait, typically a square bill, so they can throw it shallow, bang it off of rocks, logs, and stuff, and it doesn't snag. So a square bill is about the most anti-snag crankbait you can throw. It'll walk right through a brush pile. If you don't believe that, tie one on and go to shallow water so you can retrieve it if it does, but you can walk it right through a brush pile. It's crazy. It's the last thing in the world you think you can get away with, but you can do it. The square bills they deflect so well. It's incredible. You wouldn't think they do that, but they do. Go out and try it. So, not having heard that, what was your typical approach to muddy water, or did you just avoid it?
I avoided it altogether.
Okay.
There's a reason why. When the water was muddy like that, it was usually super high.
Oh, because you're fishing streams for trout.
If they're shallow, they're eating. You know, I was down there on the West Branch. That water was 3 feet at max where I was fishing. Roy, I am haunted by this. Foul up move that I made out of stupidity. Here's why it's bothering me, and it's also equally a win. I'd call it a draw because of the positives that came out of this.
Okay, that's fair.
One was this fish snapped my tippet, and neither of my knots let go. So my surgeon's knot that was above where it was, it held.
Yep.
The knot that was on the fly, it held. This is a straight up tippet snap. And when you do it and it was 6 pound test, so it was ultralight. You know what I mean? And so I had bass arms because I've been fishing for bass out on Crumhorn for the last bunch of weeks and not been out trout fishing at all. And I sat there and I'm horsing. I set the hook on that thing and kept the tension on the line like an idiot. Like it was hooked. It didn't have to. You let it run. You let it run. You keep tension on. But like I didn't just keep tension. I had my rod up, and that rod was bent. I mean, it was bent. My buddy was looking at it. I said, I even yelled, "Got you, bastard!" When I saw him roll on it. I had my sunglasses on.
Oh yeah.
I had my sunglasses on, so I saw everything. It was on the swing when the streamer swings around is when most of a trout will take. And so it was on the swing, maybe
reading the water.
15 feet down from me. And those brown trout are 100% camouflage until they move. You don't know they're even there until they, you could see them if you look hard enough, but like I didn't see them there. And so, but I did see him roll. And the torso on that fish, Roy, that would have been the fish of a lifetime. If I'd have caught that, I would have been pleased if I ever got skunked every day for the rest of my life. That thing was like, it's a lifetime chasing. I've been trying to catch a 20 plus inch brown for years. Yep. And I get skunked.
And you had him on.
And I get skunked so many days that I go out fly fishing, you know, and I had him on. He was on. And I heard my buddy who's my fly fishing guru up in Vermont. And I could hear him in my head yell, "Don't you horse that effing fish." I heard him say it, and I'm horsing the fish as I'm thinking it. And I'm like, "What? No, 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 no." And then pop, gone.
Yep. Gone.
Gone, as was the chance to hook him again, because once a big fish like that goes berserk, it scares everything else away.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So it was
fooled him, and he's graduated and not making that mistake again.
But also there was so much learning involved. I mean, so many things that I did on the way to get there. Like I made sure, I mean, I just tip it. I tied my leader long enough that, because they're very high pressured fish. Those fish they get hit on the West Branch. You drive over a bridge down there, you see 15 guys standing in the water. But there was nobody there. Also, life hack, fellas out there. And I'm sure that there's probably some fly fishermen mixed into our people, I would imagine. A little bit of people that do both. Okay. Just like skiing, midweek fly fishing or midweek any fishing. There's nobody out. There's nobody there.
That's right.
It's just like going skiing on a Monday or a Tuesday. There's nobody at the mountain. You have the whole place to yourself. Yeah.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday are the three best days on the water.
Yeah. We shouldn't even be saying that out loud. We shouldn't even be giving that one because everyone's going to be out there. Oh, we're
not everybody's retired or can take a day off during the week.
That's
so
true, but we can.
Yes, we can.
I basically live the retired life while working. I make sure that I do. I make sure.
Yeah, but your weekends are not your own.
No.
But that's when the bodies of water are crowded, too.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
I was so pissed. I'm still mad. I mean, mad, disappointed in myself because I've been studying for so, I mean, like, it has taken me the skill. Listen, I went out on the West Branch and caught fish because I caught fish before that.
But here's the takeaway. Like you said, you called it a draw because there was a positive that came out of that. Next time that happens, you're not going to make that mistake again.
No, he's going to run. Let that fish run as far as he wants to go. Yeah.
Keep just enough pressure on him to maintain so he doesn't get slack and play him out and play him like a trout and you'll land him. And there's hopefully it's an even bigger one. And there's good takeaways from that. But that's my take on muddy water and clear water. I hope there was stuff in there that helps the people out there. This last episode that we recorded, holy cow, my phone blew up with comments. Very, very positive stuff. Very, very positive. People that didn't know we had a podcast that said, I'm going to share this with all my friends. And just the comments that I've been getting, again, I can't thank the listeners enough for, number one, for listening to us. Number two, for all the positive feedback. It's very gratifying to have people telling me that they're learning a lot from it. That's the whole point in doing this. It's about getting information out there that I've been fortunate enough to write down for four decades, but I love to share it and shorten the learning curve. And that's the whole point.
Thanks for listening. And those of you out there, I also want to say thank you for heeding our request. And we request again, if you can go ahead and give us a rating on here, give us a 5-star rating on the old Spotify. If you're listening on Spotify, we've got 10 ratings now, dude. We have 10 ratings, all 5-star.
That's amazing.
Which is funny because if you look at the size of our audience, which is growing, but smaller than most of the bigger podcasts out there, we actually have more ratings than they do.
3 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's amazing. Thank you so much again for the positive feedback, for the positive ratings. It's very gratifying to us to know that for some people out there, we're actually helping you catch more fish, because that's the whole point of all this, is to help you tune into your Angler Within.